the participation of the governed. In the long run, there is no justice without freedom, and there can be no human rights without human liberty. Some, I know, have questioned the global appeal of liberty. Though this time in history, 4 decades defined by the swiftest advance of freedom ever seen, is an odd time for doubt. Americans of all people should never be surprised by the power of our ideals. Eventually, the call of freedom comes to every mind and every soul. We do not accept the existence of permanent tyranny because we do not accept the possibility of permanent slavery. Liberty will come to those who love it. Today, America speaks anew to the peoples of the world. All who live in tyranny and hopelessness can know the United States will not ignore your oppression or excuse your oppressors. When you stand for your liberty, we will stand with you. Democratic reformers facing repression, prison, or exile can know. America sees you for who you are, the future leaders of your free country. The rulers of outlaw regimes can know that we still believe, as Abraham Lincoln did, those who deny freedom to others deserve it not for themselves, and under the rule of a just God, cannot long retain it. The leaders of governments with long habits of control need to know. To serve your people, you must learn to trust them. Start on this journey of progress and justice, and America will walk at your side. And all the allies of the United States can know. We honor your friendship. We rely on your counsel, and we depend on your help. Division among free nations is a primary goal of freedom's enemies. The concerted effort of free nations to promote democracy is a prelude to our enemies' defeat. Today, I also speak anew to my fellow citizens. From all of you, I have asked patience in the hard task of securing America, which you have granted in good measure. Our country has accepted obligations that are difficult to fulfill and would be dishonorable to abandon. Yet because we have acted in the great liberating tradition of this nation, tens of millions have achieved their freedom. And as hope kindles hope, millions more will find it. By our efforts, we have lit a fire as well, a fire in the minds of men. It warms those who feel its power. It burns those who fight its progress. And one day, this untamed fire of freedom will reach the darkest corners of our world. Few Americans have accepted the hardest duties in this cause. In the quiet work of intelligence and diplomacy, the idealistic work of helping raise up free governments, the dangerous and necessary work of fighting our enemies, some have shown their devotion to our country in deaths that honored their whole lives, and we will always honor their names and their sacrifice. All Americans have witnessed this idealism, and some for the first time. I ask our youngest citizens to believe the evidence of your eyes. You have seen duty and allegiance in the determined faces of our soldiers. You have seen that life is fragile and evil is real, and courage triumphs. Make the choice to serve in a cause larger than your wants, larger than yourself. And in your days, you will add not just to the wealth of our country, but to its character. America has need of idealism and courage because we have essential work at home, the unfinished work of American freedom. In a world moving toward liberty, we are determined to show the meaning and promise of liberty. In America's ideal of freedom, citizens find the dignity and security of economic independence instead of laboring on the edge of subsistence. This is the broader definition of liberty that motivated the Homestead Act, the Social Security Act, and the GI Bill of Rights. And now we will extend this vision by reforming great institutions to serve the needs of our time, to give every American a stake in the promise and future of our country. We will bring the highest standards to our schools and build an ownership society. We will widen the ownership of homes and businesses, retirement savings, and health insurance, preparing our people for the challenges of life in a free society. By making every citizen an agent of his or her own destiny, we will give our fellow Americans greater freedom from want and fear and make our society more prosperous and just and equal. In America's ideal of freedom, the public interest depends on private character, on integrity, and tolerance toward others, and the rule of conscience in our own lives. Self-government relies, in the end, on the governing of the self. That edifice of character is built in families, supported by communities with standards, and sustained in our national life by the truths of Sinai, the Sermon on the Mount, the words of the Quran, and the varied faiths of our people. Americans move forward in every generation by reaffirming all that is good and true that came before, ideals of justice and conduct that are the same yesterday, today, and forever. In America's ideal of freedom, the exercise of rights is ennobled by service and mercy and a heart for the weak. Liberty for all does not mean independence from one another. Our nation relies on men and women who look after a neighbor and surround the lost with love. Americans at our best value the life we see in one another and must always remember that even the unwanted have worth. And our country must abandon all the habits of racism because we cannot carry the message of freedom and the baggage of bigotry at the same time. From the perspective of a single day, including this day of dedication, the issues and questions before our country are many. From the viewpoint of centuries, the questions that come to us are narrowed and few. Did our generation advance the cause of freedom? And did our character bring credit to that cause? These questions that judge us also unite us, because Americans of every party and background, Americans by choice and by birth, are bound to one another in the cause of freedom. We have known divisions which must be healed to move forward in great purposes, and I will strive in good faith to heal them. Yet those divisions do not define America. We felt the unity and fellowship of our nation when freedom came under attack, and our response came like a single hand over a single heart. And we can feel that same unity and pride whenever America acts for good, and the victims of disaster are given hope, and the unjust encounter justice, and the captives are set free. We go forward with complete confidence in the eventual triumph of freedom, not because history runs on the wheels of inevitability. It is human choices that move events. Not because we consider ourselves a chosen nation. God moves and chooses as He wills. We have confidence because freedom is the permanent hope of mankind, the hunger in dark places, the longing of the soul. When our founders declared a new order of the ages, when soldiers died in wave upon wave for a union based on liberty, when citizens marched in peaceful outrage under the banner Freedom Now, they were acting on an ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled. History has an ebb and flow of justice, but history also has a visible direction set by liberty and the author of liberty. When the Declaration of Independence was first read in public and the Liberty Bell was sounded in celebration, a witness said it rang as if it meant something. In our time, it means something still. America in this young century proclaims liberty throughout all the world and to all the inhabitants thereof. Renewed in our strength, tested but not weary, we are ready for the greatest achievements in the history of freedom.
May God bless you.
And may He watch over the United States of America.
President George W. Bush, delivering his second inaugural address, an inspirational speech. Here is Senator Lott.
I'd like to present a very unique performance combining the United States Marine Band, the Navy Sea Chanters, and the Army Herald Trumpets performing God of Our Fathers.
Toward the end of the president's speech, you may have heard the voices of a few demonstrators interrupting or trying to interrupt the proceedings. A flag was upheld for a few moments, one gentleman shouting, "Boo, boo," as the president concluded his remarks. One other sound about which you may have been curious: when Chief Justice Rehnquist was administering the oath of office, there was a wheezing sound. For treatment of his thyroid cancer, he's had a tracheotomy, and that was the result of the sound that you heard as he administered the oath of office. Now let's listen to the music there on the west front of the Capitol.
Thank you.
the Navy sea chanters and the Army herald trumpets. The herald trumpets are the long, straightened-out variety of trumpet. They were playing ruffles and flourishes when the president came in as well. As you know, this enormous platform is constructed on the Grand Stairway.
Pastor Attorney John Falwell will deliver the benediction. And please remain standing for the singing of all of us of our national anthem. It will be led by Technical Sergeant Bradley Bennett from the United States Air Force Band. Following the national anthem, please remain in place while the official party departs the platform. Pastor Falwell.
The benediction.
Thank you, Senator Lott. Let us pray, please. O Lord God Almighty, the supply and supplier of faith and freedom, how excellent is your name in all the earth. You are great and greatly to be praised. O God, as we conclude this 55th inaugural ceremony, we conclude it with an attitude of thanksgiving. Thank you for protecting America's borders. After all, as the psalmist reminds us, unless you, O God, guard the territory, our efforts will be in vain. Thank you for our armed service personnel. And it is with unswerving thanksgiving that we pause to remember the persons who have made the ultimate sacrifice to help ensure America's safety. Thank you, O God, for surrounding our personnel, their families, their friends, and our allies with your favor and your faithfulness. Deploy your host from heaven so that your will for America will be performed on earth as it is already perfected in heaven. I confess that your face will shine upon the United States of America, granting us social peace and economic prosperity, particularly for the weary and the poor. I also confess, O God, that each American's latter days will be better than their former days. Let it be unto us according to your word. Rally the Republicans, the Democrats, and the independents around your common good so that America will truly become one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty, justice, and equal opportunity for all, including the least, the last, and the lost. Bless every elected official right now. Oh God, I declare your blessings to shower upon our President George W. Bush. Bless him, his family, and his administration. I once again declare that no weapon formed against them shall prosper. And God, forgive us. Forgive us, forgive us for becoming so ensnarled in petty partisan politics that we miss your glory and flunk our purpose. Deliver us from the evil one, from evil itself, and from the mere appearance of evil. Give us clean hearts so that we might have clean agendas, clean priorities and programs, and even clean financial statements. And now unto you, O God, the one who always has been and always will be, the one King of kings and the true power broker, we glorify and honor you. Respecting persons of all faiths, I humbly submit this prayer in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
That's the Reverend Kirby John Caldwell, pastor of Windsor Village Methodist Church in Texas, which is an enormous megachurch. He's an old friend of the president's and delivered the benediction at the first inaugural as well. And now we have the national anthem.
Say, can you see by the dawn's early? stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight. O'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the rockets red glare, the bombs bursting in air,
Air Force Technical Sergeant Bradley Bennett singing the national anthem. The President and Vice President step up to the platform again and wave to the crowd. At this point, when the presidential party leaves, the crowd will begin to disperse, but in fact it already has begun to leave the Capitol grounds. The President is greeting members of his family. He and his wife, holding hands, followed by their daughters, are headed back into the Capitol building. There will be lunch served in the Capitol today for the platform party, and that will be followed by the parade down Pennsylvania Avenue. We can see at the beginning of Pennsylvania Avenue where the floats are clustered, waiting for their big ride. And as we look down the mall, the tremendous wide park that stretches from the back of the Capitol to the Washington Monument to the World War II Memorial to the Lincoln Memorial, we can see people up and down that long snowy stretch moving into place to watch the parade on Pennsylvania Avenue. The President has left the platform. This inaugural platform is built on the grand staircase that sweeps down to the mall and to the foot of the Capitol grounds, and they level out the staircase to build this platform. And on the terraces above, that's where the sea chanters are, and another crowd of important guests. And the crowd is now beginning to slowly, but much less ceremoniously, make its way off the platform. They came in the strict order, sort of leaving as they can get to the doors. But this has been a very impressive ceremony and an extraordinary inaugural address delivered by the President. It seems to me that, Neil, that it was a kind of an address that reached out. It was patriotic and inspirational, filled with references to faith and so on. But some very interesting notions came to my mind listening to the speech about what the President's plans are for the next 4 years. And when he talked about how America's vital interests and our deepest beliefs are now one.
Linda, let's get some reaction to the President's speech. With us here in Studio 3A are two political strategists, Republican Frank Donatelli, former political director for President Reagan, Donna Brazil, former campaign manager for Gore Lieberman in the 2000 campaign. And Frank Donatelli, let's begin with you. The extraordinary speech, the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world.
You know, if Woodrow Wilson had given a third inaugural, I think this would have been it. As limited as the president's inaugural address in 2001 was, this was extraordinarily expansive, talking about liberty and the goal of the United States to spread liberty around the world, and the unspoken part of the speech, which is that the best way to fight terrorism is to dry up the so-called root causes of terrorism and that means more self-determination. It's an extraordinarily broad statement. As they say, the devil is in the details.
Donna Brazil, this was not mere rhetoric. The president went back to this again and again. America will not pretend that jailed dissidents prefer their chains or that women welcome humiliation and servitude, that any human being aspires to live at the mercy of bullies.
And there's no question that the president drew on the power of freedom to conquer evil, the evil of tyranny, the evil of terrorism. I found it amazing that he used so many religious overtones to talk about freedom in the most expansive way of how the human soul not only desires freedom, but the human soul needs freedom. I think that was his greatest call, and he drew upon his strength as a wartime president, used again the backdrop of September 11, I believe, to give us this thematic context today.
The Day of Fire, as he referred to it. There was no direct reference either to Iraq or Afghanistan. Clearly, though, that's what he was talking about much of the time.
Well, you know, the president is fond of saying now that freedom is on the march in that part of the world, and clearly he intended to talk to those nations as well as other nations that perhaps may be on his agenda now.
And Frank, briefly, he did also, as we were told to expect, talk about the ownership society here at home.
Yeah, I thought that his transfer from liberty abroad to an expanded definition of freedom at home to include some of his domestic elements for the second term of an ownership society was pretty well done, but didn't talk about that. I think he's going to reserve that for the State of the Union in about 2 weeks.
And the specifics that we won't get until the State of the Union message that is, of course, a much more specific address.
I guess when we look back at this speech, we'll talk about what it missed. And he didn't really talk about his domestic agenda, his domestic vision. It was more of a sweeping vision of the world and how in America he will attempt to spread freedom and liberty through the creation of an ownership society.
Donna Brazil and Frank Donatelli, stay with us. We'll have more from you later. And you're listening to live coverage of the presidential inauguration in Washington, D.C. from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is live coverage of the presidential inauguration. I'm Linda Wertheimer at the West Front of the Capitol.
And I'm Neil Conan at NPR Studios in Washington.
NPR's legal correspondent Nina Totenberg joins us now to talk about Chief Justice Rehnquist, who swore in the president just a few minutes ago. Nina, we saw the chief come in walking in a kind of halting way with a cane. He was, his voice was not strong. We could hear the sort of peculiar sound of the, I guess, whatever the device is that enables him to speak with a tracheotomy.
Well, what you don't know about the chief is that most people don't know is that he broke his knee over a year ago, and he's walked with a very pronounced limp, almost looking like his leg would give out ever since. And you add to that the effects of chemotherapy and radiation. I thought he looked remarkably good, much better than I expected. He didn't look gaunt. He has very serious thyroid cancer, as we know. He didn't look terrible. He has something called, a passimural tracheotomy, which allows you to speak by having the air go over your vocal cords. And it sounded just like him, just softer, with that slight airy tone to it.
With a sort of a hiss, little bit of a hiss
right.
in his voice. But he was, I thought it was something, it seemed to be something of a milestone for the Chief Justice that he should be here for this inauguration. He has sworn five inaugurations he's presided. I guess that's three presidents. And he very much wanted to be here and was determined to do it.
And it's really quite remarkable when you think about it. He's been very sick. He, with the exception of the cases in 1 month, he's continued to work. He has started to preside at the conferences that the justices have, the private conferences every week. He does not sit on the bench because he has this tracheotomy. That means he can't swallow his own saliva, so you have to use a suction device, which would be a little disconcerting on the bench. And it's also the reason you can be sure that he left after swearing in the president. They didn't show it very much on television, but he did. Right. He left. He walked up the stairs. But the fact that he could walk up and down those stairs on his own using a cane, or I couldn't quite tell if it was one or two, but it's
just one kid. Yes, right.
I never expected him. I thought they would have to wheel him in a wheelchair. I thought it was amazing, and he looked pretty good.
He had an aide and a military aide near him in case he needed help, but as you point out, Nina, he didn't need them. Thanks very much. NPR's legal correspondent, Nina Totenberg.
Thank you, Linda.
NPR's Pam Fessler is among those who was in the audience as the president spoke. She's now on her way to the inaugural parade. It's assembling. It will, of course, make its way down Pennsylvania Avenue from the Capitol to the White House later today. She joins us now by phone. Pam?
Yeah, hi, Neil.
What was it like?
Well, I'm now standing in a huge people who are still waiting to get through the security checkpoint so that they can see the parade. Some people have been waiting here an hour and a half. And I have here Christy McDaniel, who has just moved here from Washington, just moved to Washington from Austin, Texas. Here she is. One second. Hello?
Hello, Christy.
Hi.
Can we get your reaction to what you saw and heard today?
So far, I'm very impressed. Everybody's been rather civil. You've got your supporters and your protesters, but they're at least respecting, I guess, each other's opinions. So that's nice to see.
We did hear one little outburst from protesters and then Bush supporters coming back with four more years.
Right. So at this moment, it's just a little competitive banter. It's a lot of fun.
And what brought you from Texas to Washington, D.C.?
Actually work, but it's been kind of fun to sort of follow former Governor Bush, you know, up to D.C., so.
And how cold is it, Christy?
Oh, it's not cold at all. I mean, I guess compared to Austin, it's kind of chilly, but it's actually a pretty warm day for D.C. temperatures, so it's not bad at all out here. And quite honestly, the crowds are in there keeping us warm.
Were you able to hear the president's speech?
No, we were not.
Okay, well then I won't ask your reaction to it.
You kind of had to pick either the inauguration or attempt to get to the parade.
Well, have a good time today. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Would you be kind enough to hand the phone back to Pam, please?
Sure. Hang on a second. Hi, Neil.
Hi, Pam. So from where you are, can you see the preparations for the parade getting underway?
No, I actually can't see anything. This intersection is jammed with, I would say, maybe 600 or 700 people all waiting as I get through the security checkpoint.
And there's more chance of four more years, we can hear in the background of your phone as well there.
You have chance of four more years and chance of Bush must go. So, but actually, it's actually pretty good-natured. It's almost like street theater going on here.
Pam Fessler, thanks very much. We'll be checking with you in later in the day. Appreciate it.
Okay, thanks a lot.
And again, the inaugural parade is assembling. And in the meantime, the crowd there at the west front of the Capitol, Linda, has largely dispersed. The president is inside the Capitol now for the traditional lunch.
That's right. There is all of the important people have found their way into the building or are finding their way into the building. And the crowd that has been gathered on the grounds is just about gone. But they're all moving, or many are moving, down toward Pennsylvania Avenue, where, as I said before, we can see the floats that will be in the parade, and the bands are assembled on the side streets. We have a beautiful view of the parade from here. We're going to talk for a moment to Peter Robinson, who is a former speechwriter to Vice President George Bush and President Ronald Reagan. He is now with the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Mr. Robinson wrote one of Ronald Reagan's famous phrases, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." Peter Robinson, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So this was a speech which was very, very different in tone from the president's first inaugural address, where he talked a great deal about humility and that the United States should not be arrogant and so on. This was a speech which essentially asserted the power of the United States and the essential ideas of this republic, and the power of those ideas and this country to change the world.
I couldn't agree more. The speech was well-written, in places just beautifully written, well-delivered. We have to remember how difficult it is for a person to stand in front of the entire world and get through a speech without tripping on himself. The president did that.
But I think it was practically perfect, in fact.
Practically. I couldn't agree more. Poor Denny Hastert couldn't administer the oath of office without tripping on a word or two. I'm sure I'd be the same. It's a nervous-making position to be in front of the world. George W. Bush pulled it off beautifully. The speech was breathtaking in its scope. He wants to remake the world and, I think this is likely to be commented on more in coming days, remake the Republican Party. He said the survival of liberty in our land increasingly depends on the survival of liberty in all lands. Very nice phrase, by the way. But here's what John Quincy Adams said. We go not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. And that hesitance, even in Cold War presidents, Eisenhower, even Kennedy, even Ronald Reagan, we will use force to the extent that we must to contain the menace. But even in those Cold War presidents, you don't see a practical plan, a real claim to remake the world. George W. Bush is saying we must go abroad, we must find the monsters, and we must destroy them. He's inverting a large element of the entire American tradition in foreign policy. That is breathtaking.
Well,
as to the Republican...
When the president went to war in Iraq without, as he said, without waiting for the threat to really materialize, that also was a big change. And this speech sounded to me, I wondered if you thought so, sounded to me like perhaps there's something beyond Iraq in the president's mind.
Could very well be. Of course, I was thinking, picturing Jacques Chirac watching this speech in the Élysée Palace over in Paris, and I'm sure he's on the ceiling at this point. There's nothing in this that would suggest to any foreign leader that George W. Bush intends to conduct his foreign policy with anything like the humility that a Jacques Chirac would think fitting. What occurred to me, actually, I'd urge you at NPR to send a reporter to get a reaction from Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia, because as far as I can tell, this speech, its immediate effect is to pull the carpet right from beneath the Saudi royal family, who were good allies in the Cold War. Prince Bandar is a close friend of this president, President Bush Sr., this president's father, close family friend of the elder Bushes. And this speech says to the Saudi royal family, you're finished. You either figure out how to open up that country to democracy, or we will no longer support you.
A dramatic note to end on, Mr. Robinson. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. A pleasure.
Peter Robinson is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University.
And Linda, let's return and talk some more with our strategists here in the Studio 3A, Republican Frank Donatelli and Donna Brazile. Just following up on what Peter Robinson was saying there, not just to Prince Bandar, but perhaps to President Musharraf of Pakistan, who is, of course, of great assistance to the United States in its conduct of the war in Pakistan, a military dictator at this point, yet he's being challenged by this address as well.
You know, freedom is not free. In order for this message to go over well in parts of the world, like the Middle East and parts of Africa and other places, it requires the United States to make a huge sacrifice of its own to begin the dialogue, to begin the conversation with its so-called allies in the war on terror. This is a tough speech for them to absorb, I'm sure, because there are many dissidents in their own countries that are trying to get the spotlight to become more visible in their outrage and what's happening in their own countries. And if the president is now unleashing this so-called freedom bell to these parts of the world, let's see how some of our allies will react to this speech.
Yep. Frank?
Yeah, well, I agree. I mean, we have always maintained relationships with countries that were not democracies because they have been allies for us in pursuit of foreign policy objectives. Pakistan was mentioned. Saudi Arabia was mentioned. Egypt is a third. None of these countries are democracies. I think there are Again, the implementation is the key here. Hopefully, there's going to be some time for evolution. And there are many, many models of self-determination. We shouldn't look at every society to resemble the United States in every way.
And the president spoke of that in his address. Donna Brazile, let's switch back to this country for a moment. The president did lay out some broad outlines of some of the plans he has for the next 4 years on the domestic agenda. But again, on that same question that Peter was mentioning about Jacques Chirac, was he reaching out to the Democratic Party, to the many Americans who did not vote for him?
You know, I thought at the end of his speech he talked a little bit about healing, but he didn't really didn't offer an olive branch. He offered somewhat of an olive branch when he gave his victory speech on November 3rd, but I didn't really hear that today. I thought this was an opportunity as the leader of the party in power. The president could have reached out. John Kerry was there, Bill Clinton was there, many other Democrats, but perhaps that'll come at a later time, the State of the Union address.
Yeah, I think the president will reach out, and he should reach out. But in the final analysis, let's face it, it's the decision of the opposition party to cooperate with the president or not. Because to the extent that there is cooperation, that inures to the benefit of the party in power because they get the legislative accomplishments. I think the Democratic Party is going to have to make their own decision as to whether or not it's in their interest to compromise. I think in some issues it will be in their interest, and in some of them it probably will not be.
But as opposed to let us all come together, more of a follow me speech.
Well, this is not a wartime. This is not a coalition government. It's a Republican government. You hope that you can get Democratic support for selected initiatives. But on most things, and I would separate the war on terror from that because I think you can get bipartisan cooperation, on most things, most Republicans will be for the president, most Democrats won't.
Well, we'll be seeing more of that later. Donna Brazile, Democratic strategist Frank Donatelli, of course, from the Republican side. Linda?
We're back at the Capitol where we just saw sort of a peculiar sight that I guess is one of the signs of the times. The police, the D.C. police, our Capitol police, I'm not sure who they were, but the snipers came down from the roof just a moment ago carrying their big, long bags of menacing equipment. NPR congressional correspondent David Wellner joins us now from the Capitol. David, I hope and trust you're inside the building.
I am indeed, Linda. I am on the third floor of the Capitol right outside the Senate chamber.
And how do you think this speech is going to resonate with the politicians who inhabit the dome?
Well, you know, I think listening to the president's inaugural, you could hear some of his agenda in broad strokes. You know, he mentioned reforming great institutions to serve the needs of our time right after he cited the Social Security Act as an example of a broader definition of liberty. And then he went on to say he aimed to widen ownership of retirement savings. And you put that all together, and you've got the biggest and politically most risky goal on the president's second-term agenda, which is restructuring Social Security to allow private retirement accounts. That's a change that could cost the federal government trillions of dollars. And Democrats here say they're going to fight any change that shrinks Social Security retirement benefits. And a growing number of congressional Republicans are also saying, wait a minute, you know, we could pay a huge political price in midterm elections 2 years from now if people get a sense that this is more about growing the private sector than fixing their retirement security. So, I think that there's a certain wariness on both sides of the aisle about this agenda. Another big item is restructuring and simplifying the tax code, which is something that sounds good to just about everybody at first blush, but then, you know, you get into the details of it and there's a lot of skepticism about Congress being willing to enact sweeping changes in a tax code that could wipe out lots of current tax deductions and possibly make it a more regressive system.
But still, in this broad brush speech, there were not too many specific references to specific programs. It was a sort of a dramatic speech with a lot of, I suppose, everybody who hears it takes away whatever they take away from it. NPR's David Wellner, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Linda.
And with me here in Studio 3A, and has been listening to the speech and the events today, national political correspondent Mara Liasson. And Mara, lots of talk about the broad goals of foreign and domestic policy. Let's not overlook an almost John Kennedy-esque appeal to public service during this speech. The president spoke of the need of idealism and courage and asked our youngest citizens to believe the evidence of their eyes.
Yeah, I think that was moving language. I think at one point, I'm looking for it here, he asked them to believe in something larger than themselves.
Larger than your wants, he said.
Larger than your wants, which is actually reminiscent of John McCain's campaign theme in 2000, believe in something larger than yourself. And, you know, it's interesting. Young voters, young Americans certainly are one of the groups that the White House has in mind when it is pushing its Social Security reform plan on a political level. It hopes to cement the loyalties of those younger voters who it believes will be grateful to a White House that gives them private Social Security.
And a demographic that did not support
Did not support the president, but certainly is a demographic you want to get because political loyalties are formed early and generally stick with people throughout their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Don Gagne is here with me down on the west front of the U.S. Capitol. Don, we haven't heard from you about the speech.
There was a moment before he even started speaking that I found interesting. He was introduced. He stepped up. He stood behind the microphone there, but he didn't launch right into the speech. He looked around. He stood behind him. He looked at the Capitol building. He was clearly someone who wanted to enjoy this moment. Maybe that's something that you do when it's your second inaugural address, but you really got the sense that he wanted to really soak all this in and not have it just fly by.
It is, I suppose, a moment to be savored. He had a he talked about the sort of report card of history. Not using a graceless
right.
phrase like that.
But how there will be questions that will be asked of generations.
Did our generation advance the cause of freedom, he asked.
Exactly. And he clearly feels that he is answering those questions in the affirmative. Yeah. It was a very big picture, big thinking, big ideas speech. And it's what they wanted to do. We will hear specifically about Iraq and specifically about Social Security and specifically about the tax code when he does deliver his State of the Union address just a couple of weeks out. But he did talk about all of those things without mentioning them specifically
without a particular reference. There was a little stir in the crowd when he talked about the unwanted, which I don't know, perhaps I'm wrong, but I took that as a reference to perhaps to abortion.
I wasn't sure what to make of it, but I did notice the same thing.
You're listening to live coverage of the presidential inauguration in Washington, D.C. from NPR News.
This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of